You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the first breakout session, track one. I'm Sarah Snyder, Managing Director at Ramirez & Co. We're a leading investment bank specializing in municipal bond underwriting, and I have the opportunity to moderate this panel. I was able to speak with each of the authors of the papers and the discussants, and then we have some very interesting topics to discuss with each of you in the next 90 minutes. The first is going to be trends and types of municipal defaults, both on the larger scale and smaller scale, and impact on decision-making by issuers. Then big data-based government economic monitoring and how municipalities and their constituents can benefit from the use of exogenous data. And lastly, the effect of the competitive market and its potential impact on lower concentration among underwriters. While all these topics are on different sides of the spectrum, I think each of them discusses transparency, availability of information, and how difficult it may be to generalize or compare across municipal issuers. Each paper will have the author speak, followed by a discussant, and then we'll open up for Q&A for each of the papers at the end of our discussion. First, I will turn it over to Kate Yang, who is an assistant professor at George Washington University and is one of the authors of our first papers. Then Nguyen, founder and managing partner of Axis Advisor, who specializes in high-yield investment strategies, will be the discussant for the paper. So, Kate, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon. My name is Kate Yang. I'm an assistant professor from George Washington University. Today, I'll be presenting a paper titled General Purpose Local Government Defaults, Type, Trend, and Impact. This is co-authored work with Yulianti Abbas from University of Indonesia. Okay. Some background on the paper. We've seen a few high-profile municipal bankruptcy filing cases, such as Jefferson County, Alabama, City of Detroit, Michigan, and Puerto Rico. People, after observing this, people started asking the question, are we going to see more of it? Are we going to see more bankruptcy? Are we going to see more default? Rating agencies have been reporting municipal defaults, and they have concluded that defaults remain rare. However, there are some caveats to that conclusion. The first one is that rating agencies really only examine rated bonds, specifically bonds rated by that particular rating agency. Secondly, they examine only monetary defaults because that's the most severe type of defaults where issuers do not pay interest and principal, coupon and principal on time. There are a few academic studies out there that examines the extent of defaults looking beyond rated bonds and beyond monetary defaults. However, they lack clear under definition of defaults. I'll give you two examples. Appleson et al. 2012. This is really a short policy briefing piece, and they reported 2,521 defaults from 1970 to 2011. Gao et al. 2017 reported 2,063 bond deals defaulting from 1999 to 2010. We don't know what kind of defaults they are, and we don't know what really happened because it was some rough statistics without really contents of the event that occurred. The second question that drew us to write this piece is that we are not very clear, we're not very sure about the implication of defaults, at least not based on evidence or comprehensive analysis out there. I'll give you an example. Recently, there are some media reports about Platte County, Missouri. The county had a industrial development authority that issued some revenue bond to fund a parking lot for a local mall, and the authority was not able to pay interest to service the bond on time, and the county actually budgeted some general fund money to bail out the revenue, but then later reversed position. That caused some industry analysts to question whether that will lead to some future borrowing difficulties for the county. And they are, of course, concerned about this, what I call issuer brand effect, that the issuer walked away from a bond this time, they might do it again in the future. So in this paper, we try to do two things. Well, we start by mapping out a spectrum of different types of defaults. Then using that, we code all the defaults disclosure documents from 2009 to 2015 to understand the magnitude, trend, and bound characteristics. And then a second part of the analytical sections of the paper try to understand the implication of default and to answer the question whether a non-GEO default will increase increase the yields on the future bonds of the same issuer. Okay, so how do we actually go about to answer those questions? Again, we develop a spectrum of defaults based on SEC rule 15C212. And then we start with Bloomberg event calendar, which has been used in the past to identify significant events. And then we cross-check that data with MS disclosure documents to code, based on our spectrum, the different types of defaults. We merge the default data with bond data to understand the characteristic of the bonds in default, and then lastly, to answer the second empirical question, we statistically test the impact of non-GEO defaults on future yields on the different credit of the same issuer. And we limited this analysis to general-purpose local governments only, mostly because it takes time to compile and understand all those disclosure documents, but this can be easily extended to special-purpose local governments as well. Okay, so this is a spectrum of defaults that we developed. This is based on SEC rule 15C212. We look at three types of defaults and another type called organizational. That's really just settlement for terminating defaults or ending a default status. The first one is technical, what we call technical. This includes non-payment related defaults, including, for example, most commonly observed difficulty in maintaining a debt service to revenue ratio, also including modifications to rights of security holders. And then the second type we call pre-monetary defaults. This includes unscheduled draws on debt service reserves, unscheduled draws on credit enhancement, and lastly, credit or liquidity provider failure to perform. And lastly, you have our traditional understanding and the type that we care most about potentially as investors, monetary default, principal and interest delinquencies. Okay, so we downloaded all the disclosure continuing disclosure documents and coded them based on our spectrum, and we mapped it out on this chart firstly. This is par amount in defaults, and you can see the solid line is monetary default, and you see some sharp spikes in 2011, 2013, and 2015, and those correspond to large bankruptcy cases and default cases that we know. 2011 was Jefferson County, 2013 was Detroit, and 2015 was really Puerto Rico. So it just masks the real story of what happened to other smaller issuers. So if we take those big three out, I call them big three, and they are just Jefferson County, Detroit, and Puerto Rico, we see this relatively stable trend. It peaked in 2012. It might be a lingering effect of the Great Recession, but the peak wasn't huge, and it's we definitely do not see a continuous increase over time. To put that, to turn this chart into a table, you can see some specific numbers, and again, I will focus my discussion on the right two columns, excluding the big three, and we have around 2012 when the default amount peaked about $2 billion in default in those peak years. To give you a sense of how much that represents, we estimate that general purpose local government bonds outstanding each year stands at about $2.1 trillion. Therefore, a $2 billion in default would translate to 0.1% of the market. If you only include monetary default, that's about 0.04% of the market. Compare that with what has been reported by rating agencies. For example, Moody's reported that 0.015% of bonds rated by Moody's experience monetary default. So it's slightly smaller than our estimate. And it's not surprising, right? Because those, again, rating agencies' reports include only rated bonds. And that can be seen in this table. So we split our default sample into two, rated versus unrated. Here you see on the, you compare those columns, you will see that most of the monetary defaults occur on unrated bonds. But for technical and pre-monetary defaults, it's roughly half and half, but most monetary defaults are from unrated bonds. Moving on to insurance status. Again, most of the defaults happen on uninsured bonds, and that's true especially for monetary defaults. This is unsurprising since uninsured bonds do not have that credit backing of insurance companies. Therefore, this is really confirming what we already know. And the last thing, again, probably does not come as a surprise to you that looking at bonds issued with the name of the general purpose government on it, most of them, however, are non-GO credits. If you look at this chart, this statement is true for all kinds of defaults, that for technical, pre-monetary, and monetary, non-GO credits are more likely to experience all kinds of defaults than GO credits. And another interesting observation I would draw is that if you look at this 38 CUSIPs that have experienced monetary defaults, all of them later were issued by issuers that later filed for bankruptcy. So issuers would not allow really their GO credit to go default unless they are really out of means of handling it. Okay, so moving on to our second part of analysis, many of you probably will find the first part quite intuitive. Nothing came as a surprise. So the second part is really to understand, given the landscape of defaults that I've showed you so far, what is the impact of a non-GO default on future bond yield on a different credit of the same issuer? I know there are some caveats, many caveats I've put into that question, but we're really interested in understanding this what I call a spillover effect. Once, say, a local government defaulted on their sewer revenue bond, would that spill over to other credits they have, excluding their sewer revenue credits? Okay, there are two opposing hypotheses one could come up with. The first one, I call it a credit segmentation hypothesis. This one says that a fundamental feature of a muni market is that there is a diversity of credits. One issuer could have multiple credits outstanding and could issue multiple types of bonds backed by different credits. And the issuer really has no legal obligation to commit general revenue to pay for a non-GO credit. This is our traditional understanding of the bond market. However, opposing hypothesis could be true that there is issuer reputation hypothesis, that investor might be concerned about issuer walking away from a bond. And this is rooted, I think, in the incomplete information environment on the market. Because investors do not have full information about bonds out there, they might infer risk of a bond of an issuer based on demonstrated significant financial events on other bonds of the same issuer. So if that is the case, then default events could provide a proxy for understanding the economic strength, local political effectiveness, and other factors that are common to all credits of the same issuer. So what we did to answer that question is to run a series of differences regressions where the default issuers consist of the treated group. So and the other issuers consist of the comparison group to look at how a default announcement changed future yield of the treated group bonds. So here is how the regression is set up. On the left, we have initial offering yield measured either just as is or as a spread. And then we on the right, we have a series of common suspect bond characteristics that could help explain yields. And the key variable we're interested in, and also issuer and month fixed effects. And the key variable we're interested in is the post-default variable. And it equals to 1 after the first default announcement to the default for the default localities. And then this beta coefficient there would tell us whether there is a spillover effect. If beta is bigger than 0 and statistically significant, then we know that issuers are paying higher borrowing cost potentially on future issuances after a default experience. And then we have alternative regression focusing on monetary defaults only as opposed to all kinds of default. To show you the results, first, we see that post-default variable has a positive coefficient estimate. However, it's not statistically significant, meaning that we can't really tell it apart from zero. There is close to zero. There is a chance that we really have a zero effect on future bond issuance in terms of their yields. And then if we limit our defaults to monetary defaults, only that statement holds true as well. Further, we limit our sample to GO bonds only. The argument there would be that since in the bankruptcy proceeding, GO bonds are actually could be placed at a disadvantage compared to revenue bonds because revenue bonds have specific revenue dedicated to them. So defaults might affect GO bonds more than others, and we see that there is no statistically significant positive effect either. Okay, we conducted a few other robustness checks. The first two listed on this graph are to match our defaulting issuers to some issuers that will look like them. So we adopted some matching algorithm to constrain our comparison group, essentially, to issuers located in the same counties as defaulting issuers and issued similar bonds as defaulting issuers prior to the default events. And we see that coefficient estimate for the post-default variable are still very close to zero. And then defaults happen in different contexts. We're concerned that defaults on average might not have an effect on future borrowing costs, but it might have effects for certain borrowers. So the first one that we looked at are frequent defaulters, those who have multiple types of credits defaulting. And then we look at those in high unemployment areas. And we look at issuers located in states that allow for bankruptcy. And lastly, we look at issuers that are frequent issuers on the municipal bond market, since information about them are maybe more salient to investors. And across different specifications and samples, we did not see a positive and statistically significant effect. So to conclude, what we found in this paper is that there are more defaults than reported by rating agencies, but still a pretty small share of the market. We do not see a noticeable increase over the period of analysis 2009-2015. Unfortunately, we rely on the EMMA disclosure documents cannot go before 2009, but at least for the period of our analysis, we did not see any noticeable increase in trend. Lastly, we found that GO monetary defaults are highly undesired, and they are very rare, and most of the defaults by general purpose governments are on non-GO credits, unrated, and uninsured bonds. Lastly, we find support for credit segmentation hypothesis, which is a conventional understanding of the market, that we provide empirical explanation for the relative prevalence of non-GO defaults. Issuers might know they're not punished in the future. They might feel comfortable walking away from their bonds, and they might not be as concerned as some market analysts out there. And we argue that concern over spillover is unsupported, and issuers should think twice before deciding to bail out. If they ever decide to bail out their revenue bonds and non-GO bonds, they might think twice about doing that, at least not for the reason of, not for out of the concern about spillover effects, because we didn't find evidence for that. Okay, with that, I will conclude my presentation and welcome any comments you might have.
All right, good afternoon. First I'd like to express my appreciation for the work of Professor Yang and her colleagues, because I think we need to have to add to this growing body of research about state and local government defaults. As you may know, as investment practitioners, we often use this infinitesimal default rate on munis at the aggregate level to sell bonds and market the asset class. But I think we should know better than believe our own marketing pitch, right? There's a lot. The reality behind those low numbers is much more complex, as you can imagine. And this is a very good, you know, very good first step toward understanding what the components are of that that default experience. So, you know, in terms of, I would start out here in terms of with a couple of comments on the methodology, kind of a bit more technical, if you wish. I think when you look at Professor Yang's paper, I think the first thing that jumped out at me is that, you know, she was very correct in trying to gather her own default database away from the rating agencies. And why am I saying that? Because I think what that does, it avoids what we call the self-selection issue with credit rating agency data. As you can imagine, first of all, I think issuers who are probably a little on shakier credit grounds probably are more reluctant to apply for a rating in the first place, right? So that's you have that factor. So it stands to reason that people who don't want to get a rating are probably more likely to default because obviously there's something there that kept them from getting a rating in the first instance. Also, I think issuers who did not qualify for bond insurance also went through the same self-selection process because clearly they didn't qualify for insurance. So again, that makes sense that they should have a higher probability to default. But I think I really appreciate the fact that that the study used a broader range of default definitions as opposed to just monetary default, because as most of us would know, a lot of munis get restructured before they actually get into money to default. But it doesn't mean that you can lose money, you know, as bondholders. But sometimes it doesn't get to that actual money to default. Now, a lot of them default before they file for bankruptcy. A lot of them file for bankruptcy before they get to default. So, you know, you have a lot of different shadings there, different types of levels of default, all of which may mean, you know, potential losses to investors. So this broader definition of defaults is very, very beneficial to our understanding. Now, in terms of some of the methodological drawbacks that I see with the study, the thing that gives me pause is the study period, right? From I think that she has selected 2009 to 2015. As we all know, that's kind of pretty much a rebounding period from the financial crisis and the Great Recession, and I can't help but wonder if we had more data going back even before the recession that it might not have been more interesting to observe the incidence of default, you know, going back before the recession, because I think by 2009 everything that had you know would have blown up has probably have blown up. You also note that the big three defaults actually happened after the recession, but that's also another interesting topic for study is why is it that we have these three big lumpy defaults and the rest of the market kind of gradually improved and the default rates started to decline as the period went on. So that's one point. The other one is, and I think this is probably hard for people from academia to appreciate is that you can't just use yields because you know you have to use credit spreads. You know, use spreads against the whatever the benchmark is, AAA benchmark to gauge the actual credit component of yields. Because I think you know again. You know, if you look at this period, it was generally a period of declining interest rates. So it may have muted a lot of the effects that, you know, that she was looking for. To me, that may have, you know, maybe you couldn't find a lot of potential impact on yields because maybe yield was just going down, you know, for everybody. Although the spreads for that, the issuers that were that might have been affected might have been wider, but you know, the absolute level of yields were generally declining. So in terms of the substance of the study, I would say, you know, it's nice to separate the world in terms of GO versus non-GO, but as you know, I think on the non-GO side, this is one of the challenges of municipal credit analysis, is that there's so many gradations of governmental backing, right? I mean, you have the full faith and credit GO backing, you have the limited tax, and then there's a bunch of what I call contingent liabilities, such as what we call moral obligation bonds and annual appropriations, which are kind of in this fuzzy world of is it really guaranteed by the government or is it not? And I think that debate actually is still going on today. And Professor Yang can, you know, refer to the most recent instance of I think it's a moral obligation bonds issued for a local retail mall by Black County, right? And the debate was, oh, you know, the market kind of expected the county to step up and bail out the mall. And I think a lot of people who have been in the muni business for a long time kind of went by this, you know, perhaps naive assumption that, oh, you know, at the end of the day, nobody wants to have this stain on their reputation and they'll bail out something that actually they are not officially responsible for. And if you read the disclosure documents, it actually says that, you know, that we're not responsible for this, that we may or may not bail it out, but, you know, you cannot force us. And that's kind of, this is one of the things that makes me shake my head about the municipal market. Sometimes you have these unwritten rules that are not really standing up to the market realities today, you know. It's a lot of precedents that are not holding up under the tougher legal attacks that can occur, you know, in more recent periods. So in terms of the potential spillover effect, I'm actually not as convinced that if a government unit or a city or town defaults on its GO debt, that it would not affect the related enterprise debt, for instance, you know, the local municipal utility debt. Because after all, they share the same socioeconomic base. How could it not have had an impact? And it also, I think, you know, it's a topic that's probably very sensitive to a lot of people right now, is it kind of is a little indicator of willingness to pay also. And that has to have some impact. So it's a little surprising to me that we didn't find any correlation there. And then finally, I think as I observe what the recent trends are in our marketplace, I think that actually the debate is now moving in a little more complex area, such as there are now a lot of attempts to, you know, slice and dice the revenue streams of state and local governments so that they can be pledged separately, right? This debate is very relevant to that, because you need to be able to show that, oh, you know, if I don't pledge my full faith and credit, but I only pledge this particular revenue source, that is completely insulated from the rest of my credit. And in fact, I think if I read the rating agencies correctly, I think they're all moving toward actually pulling everything under a base obligor, because at the end of the day, this economic entity that's going to be responsible for that, whether it's, you know, for the particular size of revenues or for the rest of it, but I think that's kind of where the industry is going. So just to wrap up, I think the again, this is just a great study. I think it's a great contribution to our knowledge. I would put suggestions for the study. I think perhaps, you know, extending the data back, you know, with a bit more historical data, that would be interesting. But also, you know, study the effect of these what I call contingent liabilities, like the moral obligation bonds or the annual appropriation bonds. So to show that to show local governments that, hey, you know, there are consequences to everything that they do, you know, and then they need to know what the cost of that is, and then maybe why do we have this frequency of you know, larger but less frequent defaults, like the big three. What is it that about those three credits that led to that point, even though the rest of the market was fairly stable? So thank you very much.
So we're close on time, but we want to obviously give everyone opportunity to ask questions of the panel. So if anyone has any questions, I'll hold mine to the end.
For your scarring analysis,
maybe I'm getting the terminology wrong, for the effect of GO on revenue and vice versa, were you looking at updated market prices or were you looking at prices of new issues? Because I'm concerned about a kind of selection mechanism where you default, and if you are big or prominent or otherwise creditworthy, then you get to return to the market. And so the kinds of credits that get to return to the market after a default are systematically different from the ones that don't. And so, not knowing how you treated that, I would encourage you to think about modeling the probability of returning to the market for further issuance as a potential response variable for measuring the scarring effect of the credit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right that there might be a bias in terms of self-selection into issuing a new bond after experiencing a default event. What we did, we can't, of course, it's hard to observe on the counterfactual because we don't know if they would have issued a bond if they did not default in the first place. And what we did is to look at essentially issuing frequency for those who have experienced default to see if the volume of issuance is significantly smaller than the others. And we did not find any difference there, which is suggestive of the lack of a selection, at least on that front. But again, we can't observe the counterfactual, so we can't say definitively that's not the case. But thank you for the question.
A comment on areas for future study, and Triad started to get into some of this, is that our market tends to, with all of its different kinds of bonds, including GOs and limited tax and so on, that it really clusters into three parts, which is GOs on the one end, revenue bonds with a special revenue, some sort of a special revenue pledge on the other end, and then contingent obs in the middle, being lease, appropriation, moral ob, and a couple of others. But my guess is that where a whole bunch of the defaults are going to cluster is in that third category, the in the middle category. That's a contingent liability. And as we get into a more challenging economic environment, which I think we are, I think you're going to see a lot more noise in that third category, which would be wonderful if there would be a way to separate out and look at that category independently.
Absolutely, I agree. I think it's next step is definitely to separate out the moral obligation bonds from the conduit bonds. They are very different animals and shouldn't treat them similarly.
I agree, George. I think the actually one of the big issue in our market is that, you know, if you look at state of New Jersey, right? The bigger part of its capital structure is actually in these contingent liabilities, not so much the direct general obligations. And there's always, you know, people always wonder, well, if it ever came to that, would they take the step of only defaulting on the contingent liabilities and preserve their GO rating, or how would they tackle that? So that's a very interesting topic.
At the local level, the Platte County was, you know,
right.
Missouri's got a whole bunch of these quasi-moral obs. Now they're all further at greater risk.
Yeah, and you know, and it begs the question also about how do we price these moral obligations too, right? I think obviously there has been a penalty historically, but I think investors are probably coming around to the view that maybe they didn't price it correctly, and they didn't get compensated enough for that risk.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of our discussion as well, was, you know, the generalization of a default and whether it, you know, occurring among non-GO bonds. And, you know, when you talk about a conduit issuer and bail, it's almost like you're bailing out a different entity as opposed to, let's say, something that's directly tied to, you know, the revenues of, right, of that issuer. Any other? I think there's one more in the back. We have a few more seconds.
I wondered in which category, if at all, you've considered various kinds of development district bonds, such as tax increment financing bonds, land secured bonds, special assessment, special service area bonds that are tied back to the success of a specific development project, and whether you have data on their defaults and how that fits into your analysis.
Yeah, I have minus 5 seconds, but I think that's a great question for further exploration, just to value and appreciate and dig further into the heterogeneity of different types of bonds. But I'm minus 17 now, so I'll stop there.
So thank you, guys. Our next paper is on Big Data-Based Government Economic Monitoring and Targeted Action, which will be presented by Miklos Vasarheli. I apologize if I spelled that wrong or said that wrong. He's a professor at Rutgers Business School, and then the discussant is Amelia Haviland, professor at Carnegie Mellon.
And this is a contour. Well, first, thank you for having us here. Evian Chung, my co-author, PhD student, Bill Glasgow was the one that called attention to this set of problems. We are a little bit neophytes on this particular area. Rutgers Business School's AIS group has been rated number one in the world for around 30 years in the area of accounting information systems. And recently we have kind of come across, by working with Bill Glasgow, of this kind of category of problems, and we became very excited about working it. And we are, the main reason to talk here and to talk in other places is basically we would like to find municipality, not too small, not too large, to work with us and develop these measurements. So. And, of course, that we have a Brazilian quarter, and we have been talking with the Brazilian government about trying to find something to work on this area. And basically, you have to kind of understand what world we are in and how the whole methods of measurements are changing. And basically, there is a large number of type of variables, things like social media, weather, macroeconomic measurements, etc., available in unstructured format. And these have to be organized in a way to be collected and put in a database to be used. And that's kind of a taxonomization effort. And finally, you finish up with whole set of piggybacked analytics. So it's program after program after program working on top of each other. And people are using it for a large variety of different kind of things, inferences, and the idea of monitoring a particular phenomenon, and finally taking some actions on top of it. And if you see like how the municipal world has evolved, the measurements have been pretty old-fashioned measures. And if you look at how analysts are working in the municipal domain, you're going to see that is like the analysts were working business 10 or 15 years ago. And that's really really kind of the story of the literature. CAFRs are really kind of very, very non-revealing type of measures, and budgets and the CAFRs don't match very well, and it's kind of looking at the past as opposed to looking at the future. And if you're very difficult to do anything with them, and you know you still get most of the CAFRs in PDFs and you have to extract them, is really not a very good form of measure. So therefore, the way they are being used, we don't really have very good measurements. A couple of new literature that would be nice to talk. One is Shoshana Zuboff's paper, book that came out in January this year, that basically looks at Google, Facebook, and et cetera, and say these guys have managed to measure personal behavior and create these behavior futures, which is use this to get you to buy things or to get do something. But if the most interesting about this is tying this to things like GNP measures, we can, instead of running panels and et cetera, you can actually look at a family unit that could be even of one and do some projections. So this is a total new gamut of measures that is evolving. And, of course, this kind of things are negative, and the other negative is these kind of big data measurements have been used for population control, for some very negative kind of factors. However, they can be used for a lot of good things, and this is basically the idea in this particular question. This is out of one of our papers, and it's talking about this exogenous data, third-party data, which are just exploding in volume and in nature and in number of variables for, in our case, our research is mainly in the auditing area. But we have imagined this future whereby we can audit a firm without even looking at the records of the firm, just by taking a picture of the parking lot of Walmart and extrapolating what the revenue for that particular store is, using it from satellites or from drones, and et cetera. And the number of these kind of measures, it has just exploded. And, of course, the question is always privacy. And privacy is kind of the wrong variable to really orient that. If you look at GDPR, the European Standard of Privacy, it basically says if it's for public good, you can collect the data. And actually, Arian has developed this whole idea of using blockchain on an encrypted basis to protect privacy in this particular thing. So the basic schemata around this is an idea of using external variables to measure particular social phenomena and monitor these phenomena, identify narrow domain pathologies, things like opioid addiction, wife abuse, and et cetera, and having the government act on it after extracting the data in a data protected environment. And just for you to see, for you to get the startling ability of this data, just look at it. Just think about this data, telephone users, transportation data, supermarket data, government agency data, police reports, online retailers, drug usage. Put them all together in equations. We call them suspicion functions to call your attention of the narrow pathologies that can be identified. It's a very, very powerful type of thing, and this is starting to change business. Hopefully, we could apply this to public good in a narrow pathology identification. Also, we can apply it for gross national product estimation and et cetera. It just hasn't been done. Again and again, we are having the same situation whereby government measurement and municipality measurement has lagged substantially in technology to other technologies. And this is basically the idea of using privacy protection blockchain into this, whereby you collect the data, you do some analytics on the data, encrypt the identifiers of the family block, and create these suspicion functions whereby, let's say, some index of about above 0.9, that is a cost-benefit kind of thing, is worthwhile examining. So this whole idea is identifying narrow pathologies and helping it. And, of course, the other idea that we haven't explored as much is using the same kind of data to do the kind of things you do with GNP, estimating much better measures of wealth, better measures of income distribution and et cetera, and working out of those. I could even see correlation of defaults and et cetera, like the prior paper was doing, with exogenous variables, and I would look at exogenous variables prior to that event to give you indications of that. We actually did a little bit of this, you looking at Newark, and we are looking at basically the retailers providing food stamps and the families using food stamps. And the data was pretty revealing, and with substantial more analysis, we would be able to very narrowly go directly at identifying certain family blocks that would need some degree of intervention. And this chart is actually a chart that we pulled together to thinking about the different kind of narrow pathologies that certain data could do it. I don't have a lot of time, but I want to just kind of state this. The number of social pathologies you can take is very large. And if you start thinking that you have your cell phone gives you a location. Every time you buy something, it gives you some information. The location on a taxi is captured. The macroeconomics, the weather is captured. You start thinking there are hundreds of these measurements. Some of them are really public. The other ones the government could obtain. So you can do a lot of good things with this. It's also kind of scary about privacy protection type of issues. But again, this is already is happening. Corporate, what they call corporate surveillance, and what they call what is population control is happening. Why don't we take advantage of this kind of analytic methodology and this ability of prediction to do something good? And so basically what we have at this moment is local government systems, budgets reporting schema. These don't reveal very much and give tremendous leeway for misinterpretation or at least obfuscation of quality of performance of local management. And, of course, we can overlap with these things. Hunger real-time measurements, opiate abuse real-time measurement, street cleanliness. We actually are doing a study of street cleanliness city of New York using social utterances, social media utterances, and the numbers are very different from what the state thinks their numbers are. And crime, and, of course, I could come up with 20 other of these things. And the things for you to think very carefully about is how would this change government? What kind of government guidance you need? Remember, this could be close to real-time measurements. You could see if there is a great uptick in opiate usage, or you could see if your measures are helping decrease opiate usage or deaths or et cetera, et cetera. A lot of this data exists, but haven't collected, been measured, has analyzed, or predicted. And this is now there. The question is, what can you do with this? And so, just concluding, many applications exist. Actually, many applications are in the private domain, or they are in a public domain for some other purpose. And this is what I call piggybacked applications. You go up and pick up code, mount one code on top of the other, and be able to do something different with it. It's actually very, very interesting. And corporate surveillance or population control are negative, but this is positive. And however, we are just in the beginning of this type of research. We actually are planning very immediately to actually choose a couple of problems that we have access to the data and go deeper to do a demonstration with this. And as I said at the beginning, we are looking for municipalities or groups that would have interest in working in this direction. Certainly we would like a not too small, not too big municipality to try some of these things. And I ran out of time, and I do have 4 seconds left. Thank you very much.
Hi, Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to discuss this paper in particular. It's a very exciting one. So I'm at Carnegie Mellon. The role that's probably most relevant to this is that I'm part of the leadership team at the Block Center for Technology and Society, and there I lead our center's efforts that have to do with artificial intelligence and analytics for social good. So on that note. So as many of us are aware, AI and analytics have grown like crazy, but they've mostly been used by and for the benefit of those who are already at the top of the economic ladder, the Amazons of the world. That sort of thing is easy enough to think of. And this is really a dawning of an age where they're being put to use in a lot of other areas. So it's you said you were humble enough to use the word neophyte for your work, and the field itself is somewhat new in those ways. So a couple of points. Mostly I'm going to talk about where this work, I see it fitting into that larger set of efforts, some things that are different about it, and some things that it joins into. And then I'm going to try to draw a couple of bright lines of things that we take partly from lessons learned from some places. Some of these efforts have been very successful, other not so much. And so I want to talk a little bit about a couple areas that may be useful to you, all the authors, and to many of you as the AI and analytics and big data starts to get closer to you. It may already be there. You may already be working with your own internal folks or external folks along these lines. But some of these issues may be useful as we head forward. Okay, so one of the things that they focus quite a bit on is this shift towards many data sources, right? So instead of having the one big data source that you go out, do primary data collection for, and get information that's exactly what you wanted, that has known measurement characteristics, right? So think about the way that we learn about the unemployment rates. Big survey effort, lots of science went into it to try to learn about the unemployment rate. Instead, there's a shift here to look at a whole portfolio of data products that together are used to try to learn about something. And they were not created for this purpose. They were created for other purposes, and we're trying to glean from each one of them something about the thing that we care about, right? So one example of this that's been very successful is the CDC has a flu challenge that they do every year where they're trying to predict flu rates, right? So where do we need the supplies of things? What doctors and hospitals need to be ready? And there they've done this very successfully. There's a challenge every year, and they've been able to predict in time for it actually to be useful for planning purposes. And there they have a gold standard. I'm going to keep referring back to that, a gold standard to refer to know whether they were right. Because one of the things about if we go out and use all of our science of sampling to figure out what the answer is, it'll probably be an old answer by the time we get it, but we know it's measurement characteristics. When you're dealing with this portfolio of data of different data products that are all giving us different sides of the story, it really matters if we have a gold standard to know whether what we think we're learning from all those things is actually right. And it's easy to overstate. I'm not saying they are, but many people have fallen into that trap of overstating how much these different kinds of data elements are actually informing us about the truth instead of some aspect of the truth. Okay, so that's the piece, and this is the stream that they are definitely entering in, and they're very skilled in that area. The piece that's somewhat new that I've seen less of is using blockchain-related technologies for privacy, in particular in this AI analytics for social good space. I haven't seen very much of that, and I'm very interested to see what you all come up with as you keep moving in that direction. A couple of opportunities and challenges. So I agree that looking at this process in new ways, which is what you all are doing, has great potential. To the extent that it's true, and I don't know in this space, that the measurement has been a little bit static for some time, there may be some real advantages to thinking about expanding the ways that we think about learning about the things that are relevant for you all in your decision making. There are also, and I've been part of some of these or have been around some of these, where some of that potential has gone awry. And we've either ended up coming to people with information that they already knew, and so it was not that useful, or we ended up coming up with information that created new problems, sometimes that were worse than the problem they had to start with. Okay, so I want to make a couple of distinctions that may be helpful in trying to go down the helpful road instead of the not so helpful road. So a couple questions to ask, and it's really asking for you all, is when people are coming with these different opportunities, what they would result in, does it give you information that's new to you? Right? So often, when I've gone into a new data setting where I don't know much about that area, I'm fascinated by finding out that this thing is correlated by that thing. And I go to the people who've been working in that area for 40 years, and they go, well, right. Right? So there's always a bit of that hazard, is to try to make sure that we're actually bringing things that are new to what's already known. There is a lot known in these areas. Is the information that you would bring to them actionable? So I'm going to pick on one little piece, right? So you talked a little bit about trying to make a lot of measurements much more accessible to the public who might be interested in trying to learn about how well the government's doing. And you bring up this idea of armchair auditors, right? It was a very interesting thought. And my question is, how would that information, if armchair auditors actually do get activated by these new measures that are made available and their easier access to it, do we have a mechanism for using that information if these armchair auditors are out there? Or have we created a different problem if our only mechanism is by them going to the media? Right? So any of these ideas that we have and we think we can become more nimble, right? We think we can move the government towards something that's more nimble and real-time, closer to real-time and being able to adapt, I think they're good questions to ask on the government logistics side about, is that useful to do that, or is that going to get us potentially in more trouble? And how able are we to do that, right? Are we in a situation where we can actually provide different kinds of services to different kinds of individuals in something like real time? So a couple of those kinds of questions. I want to highlight a couple of these areas where I think it can be useful to draw a somewhat brighter line. So one is between group risk versus individual risk. So I talked about the flu rates, right, where this has been really successful. And I want to make the point that that's an easier problem to solve. They want to know a rate. They want to know what proportion of people are likely to go to the doctor for the flu, what proportion of people are likely to go to the hospital for the flu. They don't need to find out who is going to go to the doctor for the flu. Who exactly? They just need to know the rate in the room, right? As opposed to who exactly. That's a really different problem, and it's a much harder problem, and it's a much more fraught problem, right? So the privacy issues get really different there. So I wanted to point that out. And the fraught part, again, there's some language that from program evaluation and policy evaluation that may be useful on both sides of this. Which is that there's a hierarchy of risk for social problems, right? So these are social problems, they're social constructs, and there's questions about who thinks it's a problem and what we think should happen because of it. So the usual ones are there's a population at risk, right, that's usually defined based on known precursors to the social problem. Among those, there's a population who's in need. That's people who are actually currently experiencing that social problem. And then there's a population in demand. And so that distinction between those in need and those who would actually be willing to use the services that you're providing, maybe a useful distinction. And then above all of that, I want to talk about algorithmic risk, right? The suspicion functions, which is saying that you as a family unit are behaving differently. That's all. Is differently. And so there's a step between that and actually saying that you're in any of these other categories. Okay, my time is short. I'll just put this up and wrap up there. Thank you.
So thank you both for speaking about this paper. Do we have any questions from the audience about this one? Okay, hearing none, then I will ask a question. So for both of you, who do you think from the municipalities would be the best candidate for something like this, given, you know, potential costs, size? What would be the best fit, in your opinion?
Me? capacity-wise to
yes.
do something not as big as Newark, something... Oops.
You got to press...
Technology. Something not as big as Newark, something not as small as tiny little community. And I think Amelia asked the question, very well question, is the setup today is very difficult to apply in usability of this information. It's very, and the other thing is this a federal problem? Is this a state problem? Is this a locality problem? You know, one of our examples is food stamps, SNAP. And that's kind of a federal program, supposedly very inefficient, fraught with fraud. And you can do some things about that, but working with locality won't help us looking at that. However, it does have a locality component on this. I never thought about the flu example, but the flu example is great in order to think about your ability to influence fact and measure. It's a very good example. And I would imagine that many other social pathologies that you care, that there has much better diagnosticity.
My guess is that many in the room might have a better answer than I would to this. There are a couple examples where I've seen a lot of useful progress where folks with those kind of skills that Miklos and his team have partnered with something like a local Department of Health and Human Services in a way that's very productive, or a local unemployment office. So things where you're needing to really think about how can we help the people who are here to move in ways that would be most useful to them. Some of those have been successful, but that's just the ones I know. So many of you may have other ideas about ways in which some of these methodologies may be useful.
Obviously, we love for this to be interactive. So does anyone have any thoughts?
I'm Bill Glasgow, and thank you, Miklos, for the shout-out on the paper. In our budget work at the Volcker Alliance, we often run across the issue of we don't know what we don't know in public budgeting and finance. This approach may have great value, or maybe even the greatest value, in the evolving area of stress testing of revenues, which Utah and Indiana Moody's Analytics also does this, but Utah and Indiana are kind of devoted to this, Utah by law, where the inputs right now are mostly macro rather than operational. But unconventional sources of data aggregated to help identify patterns for states and cities may be very useful, especially for in the area of finance, where very often you're working with CAFR data that's a year and a half old, in the case of the state of Illinois, never. So this is very interesting to us.
Yeah, no, I think, one of the things we talked about was obviously a lot of local governments use economic data, which there is a lag in that information. And I think school districts may be even a great pairing on this because they have a lot of information that they gear from just the students and what they do on a more real-time basis. My last question, if there aren't any other from the audience, given that those who would benefit most from big data, maybe understaffed, have less fungible money, how do you propose moving forward with your idea in terms of funding and being able to provide them this information both initially and ongoing?
I think this is beyond my job description. But we speculated on this. We actually want to create one example that is a startling example. I think some of it we can do at just our own resources. We have talked a little bit with the school district of Newark, which has its own stories. But, for example, data from the school district trying to direct the problem of student hunger, student absenteeism, battered children, is data that is obtainable because the objective is so even if you have to blank it out and figure out ways to create a shell for privacy, but you can link that to food stamp data, you can link that to all kind of different data that you actually might get. Just go at Google Trends and you get all kind of information that is, if you link 2, 3, 4, 5 sources of information, it gives you a cross point. And now I think the more difficult problem that Amelia, I think, raised is the problem is who will deal with this, because the structures today are designed to food stamps and kind of goes down in a schema. Now, if you want local intervention, you're going to have a local party involved. And then you're going to have all this question that we didn't think too much that you raised, this question of, are you willing to take the help? You're not willing to take the help. And who is going to be administering this help? I don't have any doubt that something like this, some little pieces of this are going to emerge and not too far in the future. But our structures today are not very good for this.
I wanted to pick up on a question you just said in your presentation about how this changes the meaning of government. And I wanted to hear if you thought about, you know, how your research might make us think differently about the social contract, about the liberal subject, about sort of what we mean by government and governmentality. And
I just again, that's beyond my job, rate. But we have talked a little bit about this thing, and the current structure of mayor of on a city or the ways municipalities is, and it kind of collides with the federal structure, and there is poor cooperation and poor way. I think we'll have to find one or two of these problems, like, for example, drug abuse, okay, which there is a lot of interest on it, and try to figure out what is the right structure to deal with this, meaning local hospitals obviously are a party on this, local providers of drugs, legal and illegal, medical. If you pull these things together, you actually come up with a reasonable picture. And, you know, preventing suicide or preventing drug overdose is a worthwhile objective. And I think if you try a few of these, a structure will emerge, and probably not one structure for a problem, not one structure for everything, but with different ways to deal with this.
Sure. Second question to the gentleman on the left here. How much have you thought of or what are you doing to prevent or how much does it scare you for some of the inputs that are used in kind of some of the third-party side, especially on social media side, with respect to the potential for manipulation of that data? If you're scraping Facebook to LinkedIn to, you know, you can...
Okay, that's a very valid question. Start that way. I was in a conference in China. The Italians had all this data, and I said, how obsolete is GNP measurement? Let's figure out a better way to do it. And when I started talking about this, I showed this to the chairman of my advisory board, a very senior CPA guy, and he said, this is government control. Don't do it. My son, who is a partner in the investment bank, said the same thing. I got very deflated until I talked with Arian and Xinxin, my two PhD students, jumped at this and said, what a great thing we can do for society, and et cetera. And then the other side is this data is being used. And maybe we can try to use it reasonably well. And meaning there is very little monitoring these days of what Amazon or Google does with this data. I don't think they are evil parties. They will be in competitive environments. And I think this is going to be a progression of society to deal with new means. I actually think this kind of big data environment is like an industrial revolution. It's a big data revolution. And the congressmen haven't been very good at regulating it. So we need to kind of think. GDPR in Europe has been a step in some direction. Well, let's see in 5 years how good that was. Yes, of course, we are very concerned about misuse and abuse.
You know, probably 25% to 30% of, you know,
know, social media is actually not real. It's a bot, right? So I could set up a few scripts to flood that woman community with a lot of opioid-looking hits, and
Actually, just to comfort you, my opinion on this is that actually we have mechanisms starting to emerge, particularly with the providers like Amazon and Facebook, etc., that progressively will be able to control. We need laws to deal with, like, for example, I can issue an opinion on the press. If I'm insulting you, you can sue me back. Now you can send a troll out, do a million of these, and there is no reaction. There has to be accountability. So I think that's going to be society slow but resolve this problem. Is the other part, you know, there is data, public data about taxi rides in New York City. So people have been using it for figuring out if the banks are trying to influence the Fed. Okay, and this is just very far-fetched. But if you start thinking about this, big data tells you practically everything. Turning off your cell phone doesn't limit people to know where you are. And we'll need rules on it, and we'll need to deal with it. But it can do a lot of good. That's what we think.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So we have our third and final paper, Competition and Market Concentration in the Municipal Bond Market, presented by Dario, who traveled all the way from Madrid. And then it will be discussed by Dr. Nicole Moran.
Hello. So I'm going to talk to you about concentration in the market for underwriting services in the municipal bond market. So the municipal bond market is a big market. They are around $4 trillion in notional value outstanding. The primary market is also huge, near 500 billion issues per year. But why are we interested inside this market? Well, despite its obvious economic importance, it's far from efficient. Credit risk premiums are too high compared to default rates. The liquidity is very low. Implicit tax rates are too high. Market fragmentation. Yields deviate from the law of one prices, and there is a lot of lack of pre-trade transparency that leads to market power and dealer brokers charging above competitive prices. And notice that the municipal bond market is a financial backbone of the U.S. infrastructure. Between 2003 and 2017, around 75% of the nation's infrastructure have been financed through the issuance of municipal bonds. So basically, when issuers want to issue bonds, they have two main methods, practically. So one is to do a negotiated sale. So basically, is you choose a bank and you negotiate a price. Or the other method is you do a public auction among banks, and you sell the bonds to the bank that offers the highest price. And the natural question is to think, okay, which one is better? There is a lot of literature trying to answer this question. This literature is especially big in IPOs, also in corporate bonds. But this literature compares auctions to negotiated sales without taking externalities into account, and my contribution is that I acknowledge that there might be some tragedy of the commons going on. Maybe negotiated sales are more convenient for the individual issuer, but less favorable if we consider the effects of the collective actions. Specifically, I study whether negotiated sales increase the concentration in the market for underwriting services for municipal bonds. And this topic is important because, in general, market concentration is correlated with market power. Market power means charging above competitive prices. And also, concentration can increase the risk of collusion. This is an important risk. Like we know, like, for example, the city of Philadelphia filed an antitrust lawsuit against seven major banks, accusing them of colluding and manipulating interest rate of variable rate demand bonds. So here I'm talking about the primary market of municipal bonds and underwriting services or different type of services. But notice that the largest underwriters are also the same seven banks accused by the city of Philadelphia. So given there are $5 billion, given that the huge size of the primary market, collusion would have gigantic costs. So my findings are that market concentration has increased substantially over time, but only negotiated sales have contributed to greater concentration. And also, the proportion of competitive sales in the state has a huge effect on concentration. Basically, going from fully negotiated to fully competitive decreases the Herfindahl index by 0.29. So the Herfindahl index is a number between 0 and 1. It's the sum of the square of the market shares. And according to the horizontal mergers guidelines of the Department of Justice, if this index is below 0.15, the market is unconcentrated. If it is above 0.25, just 0.10 above, right? Above 0.25, the market is highly unconcentrated. So notice that this is a huge effect. You decrease the Herfindahl index by 0.29, meaning that you move from being deeply concentrated to deeply unconcentrated. Huge effect. The sample that I use contains around 76,000 deals issued between 1990 and 2014 in 39 states. The issuers that I use are independent school districts with taxing power. That explains why I don't have 50 states, I have 39 states, because I don't have independent school districts in every state, and not all independent school districts have taxing power. The types of obligations that I use are long-term, so I drop all temporal issues like TANs, TRANs, RANs, and BANs. And I even use a subsample of bonds, of new money bonds, backed by unlimited and dedicated ad valorem taxes, being the only specific pledge, plus the full face and credit of the school. So I even use a sample of very specific type of security. So why do I do this? Because I want to compare apples to apples. I want to be sure that the differences that I find are attributable to the method of sale and not due to systematic differences between the bonds and compare. So basically, schools are schools in every state. They are similar across states. So pretty homogeneous type of issuer, right? They are not like we see systematic differences between or across municipalities, between municipalities municipalities across states. But schools are very similar. Also, education is a state matter. So it's regulated by state law, which brings additional homogeneity inside the state. They are not regulated by local laws. And finally, I even use a very specific type of security. And school districts are an important part of the municipal market. Between 2004 and 2014, 32% of all issues were issued by school districts. Okay, so going back to the type of security I'm using, here I have a classification of every type of securities for general obligation bonds and revenue bonds. So notice there are a lot of types of general obligation bonds, right? Not all GO bonds are created equal. I specifically use the first type for which I have an important sample. But I like many types of general obligation bonds. I choose a very specific type. Or I estimate the differences in a very specific type on top of the full sample. So these are my results. So what I do is, in every state, you observe bonds sold in negotiated sales, which I call negotiated deals, and bonds sold in competitive deals, which I call competitive deals. So what I do is, for each state, I calculate the concentration in the sample of negotiated deals and concentration in the sample of competitive deals. Plus, I also divide my sample in 5 periods of each year, of 5 years each. So, for example, you see that number there, 0.22. That means that between 1990 and 1994, the Herfindahl index was 0.22 in the median state. The Herfindahl index of negotiated deals was 0.22 in the median state. And it was, you go to the right, and you notice that during that same period, the Herfindahl index in the sample of competitive deals was just 0.12 in the median state, all right? So you notice that negotiated deals are much more concentrated than competitive deals, okay? And you see that in the full sample, you see that in the money, in the sample of new money bonds, and you see that in the sample of new money bonds backed by unlimited and dedicated ad valorem taxes with the full face, with the pledge of the full face and credit of the issuer. Plus, notice a second thing. Concentration has only increased in the sample of negotiated sales. Okay. These numbers are increasing. The columns under the competitive sales are not increasing. Okay. Of course, you might think you are comparing maybe. So you might think, okay, issuer has the choice to choose between an auction or a negotiated sale. So when you have a choice, you might have selection bias. So to overcome selection bias, I use the state's laws regarding the method of sales. So the enabling laws that authorize a school to issue bonds most of the time tells you whether you can use negotiated sales or not. So I divide my sample in two. I have a sample of bonds, which I call restricted deals, where the enabling law says you have to use a competitive sale. And I have a sample of bonds where the state law says you can choose between competitive or negotiated. And that's what I call the sample of free deals. And almost one-third of my sample are restricted deals. And more or less 50% of the sample of new money bonds. So I do exactly the same. I calculate concentration in the sample of free bonds, and I calculate concentration in the sample of restricted bonds. So notice that here you cannot choose to abide by the law or not, so there is no selection bias. And again, I find exactly the same result. Concentration in the sample of free deals, right, when a issuer can choose between negotiated or competitive, is much, much higher than concentration in the sample of restricted deals, where you are forced by law, you don't have the choice, to use competitive sales. And again, I find that concentration has only increased in the sample of free deals. Okay? So forget the table that I have there. My final remark is that I test it different across many different samples. I do a lot of robustness tests, and I show overwhelming evidence that competitive sales reduce concentration by a large amount. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, so I've got 8 minutes, slightly abbreviated. And so thank you, Dario, for that presentation. And thanks for having me at the conference. It's my first time here. Very excited. And so as Sarah explained previously, I come from a litigation background. So I have a PhD in economics, but I really am focused on litigation. So I'm going to view the paper a bit through the lens of litigation, which I think is appropriate here, given sort of the collusion and antitrust concerns. So first, just to re-motivate Dario's papers, I've been involved in quite a few cases where there's allegation of collusion by different usually government entities. So here we have Philadelphia and Baltimore. And so these cases really do look at research by people like Dario to really think about what are the positives and negatives about changes in the market microstructure. So I won't go too far into sort of recapping what Dario did, but he's basically looking at the proportion of competitive sales and how that correlates with HHI. And on a national level, he didn't show those results, but on a national level, it's not very concentrated. You know, HHI is really not very high. But on a state level, it is. And what Dario also shows in his paper is that underwriters really don't cross state lines. So the right way to look at it is actually on the state level, like Dario did. So what he finds is that when you have more competitive deals, you have more underwriters. More negotiated deals, less underwriters. That's like the main crux. Competitive deals, more negotiated, less. Now, this is just a trend over time, which I thought was really informative. You do see that the lead underwriters are decreasing, and that's the blue bars. And at the same time, you do have a general increase in issuances. So over time, you are seeing less underwriters in the market. And on the right is the different states. So darker blue is higher HHI. So Montana, for instance, is quite concentrated, or the great state of Texas is not very concentrated. You see the white color. So there's quite a bit of variability just over the country. So I'm going to have three suggestions, which are really driven by my litigation experience in what questions we ask when we're preparing expert reports or preparing experts for deposition on these types of subjects. So my first suggestion for the paper is to add a big, fulsome section on the economics of the differences between competitive and negotiated deals. And so, you know, besides regulation, what deal characteristics drive the choice between competitive and negotiated sales? Because Dario makes the comment in his paper is that even when states are free to choose whatever they want, there's no restriction, they still are choosing negotiated deals. And just leaves the reader saying, why is that, right? We don't have a bunch of irrational people running around in municipalities. So I think a little bit more about, you know, even when people can choose whatever they want, they're still choosing negotiated deals. And then thinking a bit about why one might lead, one type, competitive or negotiated, might lead to more concentration than the other. And finally, thinking about if the underwriter concentration is a byproduct of specialization, right? So we see a difference in concentration, but is it possible that it's just due to more specialization by the underwriters? Okay, second suggestion is 2 out of 3. Second suggestion here is interpretation of the main results and a bit of caution about causality. So the results show a very strong negative correlation between the proportion of competitive deals and the concentration of underwriters. So a 1 percentage point increase in the proportion of competitive sales decreases your HHI by about 0.29, or usually the DOJ will do 2,900. And so this is a pretty big effect. What's missing right now from the paper is sort of intuition about why new deals in refunded bonds, the coefficients are really different. You know, one is 0.26, the other one is 0.11. So a little bit of thought or maybe a paragraph or two about, you know, why that is actually happening. And I do think that we have to be a bit cautious about saying that increased concentration of underwriters is unequivocally harmful. It may not be harmful. We might see this trend, but it may actually not be harmful to municipalities. So here are just two statements that I thought in the paper were a little bit strong and that we should think about sort of the opposite side of things. Okay, and then one last comment on here is Dario and I have been exchanging emails about a potential endogeneity issue, which he's working through right now, where we can think about if the correlation can actually be turned into some causation. So stay tuned for further research from him. And the last suggestion is who is harmed and by how much? And this is really important in litigation because oftentimes, you know, we are thinking about, you know, if there was some collusion or antitrust behavior, what are the damages? You know, who needs to get paid and how much? And so right now there's not much in the paper about harm. So this goes back to, is concentration bad? We need to figure out if concentration is bad before we can go much farther in many of these cases. So, you know, would we expect underwriter concentration to be harmful to the bond market? If it's the result of specialization, it could actually be helpful, and it could be helpful to different municipalities. And you know, if we have concentration, does that lead to higher yields or fees, and sort of by how much? Is it significant? Is not statistically significant? And these are really, really important questions when you're thinking about making policy decisions. And then who's being hurt? And so basically, who needs to get paid in these types of cases? I do think that some clarity on the literature would be helpful, a bit selfishly, but when we are writing expert witness reports or doing research, if there's conflicting papers, we want to understand why. So Dari's been doing some work previously. He was here 2 years ago with a paper, and I know he's done a lot of work since then, but the results somewhat flipped, meaning that previously, when there were restrictions on negotiated sales by states, it was harmful, meaning that there were higher yields. His new paper is finding that competitive deals have lower yields. So I would just encourage the paper to really explain sort of what happened and the evolution of the analysis that has changed the result. And with that, I'll conclude my results. Thank you.
Thank you both. Of course, obviously, as a municipal bond banker, I have many opinions of the presentation, as well as agree with a lot and disagree with a lot. And of course, coming from a firm that was not part of any of the collusion, have to obviously state that. But I do think that obviously there's a lot of great information in here. I would love to obviously get any questions from the audience before I do any.
So I'm not sure how credible I find the arguments that I'm about to make, but you do with it what you will. So many people have argued that there are big benefits to having negotiated sales and that those negotiated sales, and that's why negotiated sales happen. I think that the reliability, the ability to get specialized attention and expertise in your finances that would be costly to develop and therefore hard to get a negotiated sale. And I think it would be ideal if you could address, imagine it this way. We're in a world where perhaps where there is both a more competitive and cheaper outside option of using competitive rather than negotiated sales, and yet we see over time an increasing market share of the negotiated sale market. So this is kind of weird to believe unless you believe that there's something that they're getting out of it, right? So I'd like it if you could in future work engage with what are they getting out of this, and can we quantify whether or not it's sort of reasonable that they're getting that relative to what they're paying for it.
So that's something I want to know too, because if you check the literature, especially the one in IPOs, all the reasons that they state or they find why people use negotiated sales do not apply in the municipal loan market, and yet we see more and more negotiated sales. So for me, it's a puzzle, and I want to ask the people in the industry why. And that's definitely something the academics, for sure, they don't know. And that was something that I want to say in another paper. Hey, all the things that explain negotiated sales for IPOs cannot explain negotiated sales, why people use to negotiate the sales so much for municipal bonds.
We have time for literally like one more question. Otherwise, we have to run.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, did you control for credit quality or ratings or anything like that? Because, I mean, obviously, you ask Sarah, she would say, well, you know, you can go competitive for the cleaner deals, the deals that are very easy to price, and obviously you go to negotiate route for things where the story has to be told and has to be placed with the institutional investors and whatnot. Is there a way to test for that?
Well, a good thing about working with school districts and you have the state laws, that I even perform, I don't know if I have it in the paper or not in appendix, I even test the differences in schools where you have a state guarantee. So basically all the bonds in the state have the same credit risk, and you still find these differences.
Thank you.
Yeah, and to your point about the benefits of negotiated versus competitive, it is information that I've been starting slowly to share with him over time so that we can incorporate that into your paper going forward. But obviously there are a lot of strong benefits to a negotiated transaction, and you'll see that a lot of issuers aren't necessarily doing 100% one versus 100% of the other, but try to blend the two to be able to benefit from both types of transactions. Any other questions? One more, and then we'll go.
Just a very fast one. The municipal bond market is almost unique in that most issues are serial issuance. So a 30-year bond is essentially 30 different CUSIPs. So how do you figure that in your analysis of competitive versus negotiated? Do you take a weighted average maturity, or because one of the supposed advantages of negotiated deals is being able to supply demand all across the curve.
So currently, I'm working at the deal level, so the entire deal includes the whole series. So it's either the whole deal is competitive, negotiated. I don't control for the maturity of the deal, but that's a good thing about working with school districts, is that they are issuing for the same things, and the maturity is stated by law. So if you're going to build a new building, you can issue 30 years bond, or depending on the state law, between 20 and 30. If you're issuing bonds to buy school buses, the maximum maturity has to be 10 years. Or if it is for computer, 5 years. So even the maturities I'm using are exogenous. Depends on the project. And school districts across the state, they all need to issue bonds for the same type of projects. So kind of, I'm not directly including maturity, but kind of controlling for maturity. I have to do my test. Like, there are many things I have to do.
Yeah, to your point that, yes, obviously a negotiated transaction allows you to tailor to the investors that are buying the products. And I think the research that was put together was more on a larger scale, but within school districts, of just the concentration of underwriters, but not necessarily the impact on the pricing. So... well, thank you all for joining us. I hope you found that the three papers were very interesting. Of course, feel free to reach out to any of the speakers, discussants, or myself if you have questions, suggestions, as they move forward through their papers. Thank you all.